welcome everyone to today's Kluwen Internet Seminar. Today's session has been sponsored by the EPA's Office of Brownfield Land Revitalization, and we'll cover area-wide planning, specifically looking at coordination opportunities with HUD. My name is Jean Balance. I'm coming from EPA's Technology Innovation and Field Services Division, and I'll be filling in for Michael Adam as a moderator to help with the online broadcast today. Just want to cover a few basic reminders for everyone and give our participants just a few last minutes to hop on and join us before we officially begin the formal presentation for today. Just a gentle reminder to everyone who signed up, you should have a copy of the presentation materials in front of you. You are either looking at them through a web browser window or should have already downloaded them as PowerPoint or PDF files. If you haven't done so, I just want to remind everyone you can access those materials from the seminar homepage. It was the same page that you used to sign up. It would have been a URL that was shared with you by confirmation and reminder emails as well. On that seminar homepage, you could see a complete description for today's event, a listing of our instructors, including their contact information, and there were also options to either click a button that appears on the left side to go to the seminar to look at the slides online, or you could simply follow the links at the bottom of the seminar homepage to download the slides as either PowerPoint or PDF file formats. So everybody should be looking at slide number one, which is our title slide. I'd ask that you move along to slide number two, which has some general housekeeping or brief reminders for everyone for today's session. As we mentioned, if you're on the phones, we ask that you place your phone on mute so to minimize disruptions. You can simply use your own mute button or hit star six to mute your line. The instructors are willing to take questions as soon as they come up, so if throughout today's presentation you do have a question or would like to make a comment, you're welcome to take yourself off of mute and make that comment or ask that question at that time. And to unmute your line, you'd simply use your own mute button or hit pound six. Remember, though, when you're done making your comment or asking your question, we would ask that you remute your line with the star six. So it's star six to mute and pound six to unmute. Again, if you're not presenting or you're not speaking, we do ask that you keep your phones on mute to minimize background noise. And I can hear a little bit of rustling right now, so again, just a reminder, please mute your phone lines. You do not put the call on hold. There could be background music or commercials that could be disruptive. You can certainly hang up and dial back in if you need to. There won't be any disruption to us. Again, questions can be asked at any point in time if you're listening to us on the phones. For those of you who are streaming the audio online, you actually have a series of buttons that will appear on top of your slides. And one of them is a question mark icon that you can click on. And as long as your pop-up blinkers have been disabled, a new window will open up, which will allow you to type up comments or questions electronically. Again, you can submit those at any point in time throughout today's session. And when you do, I will read them out loud on your behalf to the instructors so they can answer the questions. So no need to hold the questions till the end. Again, feel free to ask them at any point in time throughout today's session. As I mentioned, each individual participant will be required to manually move through the materials at verbal cues from the instructors. So the instructors or presenters will indicate when they've moved on to the next slide. Currently, I'm on slide number two. If you have a hard copy, you simply have to turn the page. If you're looking at the slides online, you can either use the numbered links that appear on the left side, or you can use the arrows or icons that appear along the top of your slides to move through. The single arrow pointing to the right will move you forward one slide. The single arrow pointing to the left will move you backwards one slide. A final reminder that this session is being recorded and will be archived. Everyone who signed up for today's session will automatically receive an email as soon as the archive is available, and you'll be able to replay that session online or download it for future reference. And you can certainly go back now and check our current archive collection of almost 400 different recorded sessions for free through Kluwen's archive page, which is listed on slide number two. When we're all done for today, you'll be directed to a final slide, which will include two important links. The first link will be a feedback form, which will prompt you to fill out feedback. It just takes a few seconds to fill the form out and let us know what you thought of today's session. If you're looking for confirmation of your participation today, filling out the feedback form will allow you to check a box so you can actually have a confirmation email sent to you for your own records. If you're sharing the line with people, we'll indicate how you can have multiple participants submit feedback on one computer. The other point that we'll mention as well is that an additional resources page has been included where you'll be able to download today's PowerPoint presentation as well as take a look at other resources that have been collected related to today's topic. And those are the end of the reminders that I have on slide number two. So with that, I'm going to move things on to slide number three and turn things over to EPA to begin the formal presentation.
Well, this is Charlie Barch, and I'm Senior Advisor for Economic Development in Oswer, and I want to welcome everybody on the line to our fourth in the series of webinars looking at some of the different federal agencies and how they can be integrated into implementation of an area-wide plan and other types of activities. We have three speakers today. Krista Mills, who's the HUD Field Office Director in Kentucky. Mary Oakley, who is with the Ohio Department of Development, and Kimball Krangle, who is Senior Developer with the Denver Redevelopment Authority. Today we're looking at the HUD programs, and we're going to focus on, in particular, the HUD Community Development Block Grant Section 108, the Sustainable Communities Program, and if we have time, get to a couple of others. So the HUD programs are really key economic development and community development tools. In many cities, there is a lot of pressure on the CDBG funding, but it's important to note that the CDBG and other HUD funding can be very flexible, and these resources can be very well suited for the kinds of activities that you might want to carry out as part of an area-wide planning strategy. How we've got this organized today, and I want to thank our speakers for putting so much time into helping us develop what we hope will be a seamless webinar laying out this information. Krista is going to provide some of the specifics from the HUD vantage point, but it's important to note, particularly in the context of the Community Development Block Grant Program, the CDBG program structure gives a lot of latitude to states for delivery of CDBG dollars to small cities. And there's a number of small city area-wide planning grantees that I think might find this information helpful. So what we've asked Mary to do is really from the state perspective, give the state take on how a state development agency may structure the delivery priorities and mechanisms for the state allocated HUD block grant money. Ohio's been, as a state, very creative and really getting resources out to its small communities for the kinds of activities that many of the area-wide planning grantees are hoping to carry out. So we're really pleased to have Mary participate. As Jean said at the beginning, we want to encourage questions. There's a lot of information here, some of it pretty technical, so please, if you have questions, feel free to either send them in or ask them. And with that, I am going to turn it over to Krista, who is going to get us started. Go to slide 3.
Great. Thank you so much, Charlie. I appreciate being on here today and all the effort EPA has done to bring this all together for us. And I will apologize in advance, and you just heard it. I have three lines that come into my office, and I cannot mute the other two lines. So you may hear some beeping once in a while there in the background. Okay, the first slide. Some of you on the call will recognize these cities. I thought it was a good place to start because they represent different size cities, and they're all planning grant recipients. The first on your left-hand side is Goshen, Indiana. And they're part of a three-county region that has about 200,000 people, but the city itself has 31,000. And then you see next to that is Roanoke, Virginia, which, and I hope I have the right census data, but it's slightly under 100,000 people. And then you have Kansas City, Missouri there on the bottom, and they're in a metropolitan statistical area of over 2 million people, so represents different types of CDBG grantees and eligible applicants for the program. So advance to your next slide. The CDBG program began in 1974, and it is, as Charlie mentioned, one of the most flexible programs that HUD has, and it's been one of the programs that's been running the longest. If you've been following the news at all, please be aware that this money is continuously threatened, but even more so here in the 2012 budget debate. So I would suggest that you follow that very closely to see how that plays out. The eligible grantees are principal cities, as we just saw with Kansas City, in metropolitan statistical areas, other small cities with a population of at least 50,000, and then the urban counties with 200,000, and then state governments such as Ohio, when you hear from Mary, in regard to how they run their program. So they work with the small units of local government. Go ahead. also known as the Small Cities Program. Okay, the as you see there, there are three requirements and in regard to qualifying for CDBG funds, whether you're asking for the funds through the state or you're in an entitlement city, such as Kansas or Louisville or Cincinnati, where you get the funds directly from HUD, that you have to meet one of these three requirements in order to receive the money or apply for the money in the state program. So it doesn't have to be all three. It could meet all three. Generally, it's going to be in category one or two, as listed there, that you'll be applying for funds or see that they're most applicable to your goals and your plans. The there are some compliance. Let me back up just a moment. The when you look at the people who benefit from it, as it says, the low to moderate income people, when we look at anything that qualifies for CDBG funding, you have to have at least a 51% benefit. So the majority of the people in a particular area, or if it's an economic development activity, at least 51% of the people have to be low to moderate income people that benefit from the federal funding. The what we see generally is it's about across the nation is 95%. And there are some standards that stretch over a year to 3 years in terms of requirements for a 70% benefit overall. But that would be your first test, is to make sure it meets the 51%. So there are compliance. There are a number of compliance issues. I've just highlighted a few here. So if you're looking for threshold evaluation of the project that you might be looking at, of course you need to meet the very first of it being statutory and regulatory eligibility. So statutory eligibility would be one of those three categories above. Then you want to look also at categorical eligibility, because you could have, for instance, there is an eligible a category for public facilities, and so you could be applying for money to do a community center, and however, and of course that would be a public facility, but a public facility is also a government building, but that would be ineligible under that category because you cannot use the federal funds to run local government or the building itself. So also you want to look at the meeting one of the national objectives, which is what you'll hear those three categories above called. And then there's also a review of the what is reasonable for the project that's proposed. And sometimes we see things that are underestimated, and sometimes we see things that are overestimated. So you certainly want to do your review first.
Mary, this is Chad. If I just ask a quick follow-up on that. In the context of, say, site cleanup estimates or site preparation estimates, would HUD, you know, sort of accept as part of that, you know, sort of standard, you know, sort of, you know, consultant estimates that might be prepared as part of a project plan?
Now, Charlie, you said Mary. Did you want Mary to answer that question?
Sorry, I meant Krista. Sorry about that.
Okay. I believe so, but I don't know that right off the top of my head. But we could certainly find out and make sure that question gets answered for your folks on the line.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. Next slide. As we, as I just mentioned, there are two ways in which the money is distributed nationally. And I have this slide in here just to remind you of what those two categories of how the money is distributed, but also I want to mention the consolidated plan and the action plan. The consolidated plan and the follow-up action plan are required of any of the entitlement communities, whether it's those that receive direct funding or an entitlement such as the state, who then distributes the money through Small Cities Program. And I mention that because it's important for you as planners and folks working with these area-wide planning grants that you know you can influence that process, because there is a public participation requirement by HUD in the consolidated plan, which is a five-year plan, and the follow-up one-year plans, which are the action plans. So there are public hearings, and there is interaction between you and the entity developing the plan. They're also available to the public in a number of different ways, which is one of our requirements. So you can common places would be online or in your public library or available in your city or state government. Okay, next slide. Excuse me, next slide. All right, and Charlie, this may answer one of your questions as we go through some of these eligible activities. There are three categories of eligible activities, and there are subcategories under the benefits to low and moderate income people. So you have what's called an area benefit. You have specific population benefits, jobs and economic development, and housing, and we'll go through each one of those and then move on to the other two categories. So most of what you would see would be in the first category and the second category. Urgent need category is a little bit different. And some activities there, when you talk about area benefit, it could be, it's a very large area that many people who are of low income would benefit from as opposed to a very specific site or a one development kind of type of thing. So you could, you see some of the examples there. Street improvements could include sidewalks, could include curb cuts to make the neighborhood accessible for those people with disabilities. The connection to water and sewer lines, you would see oftentimes in cities that have HOPE 6 grants, the revitalization grants that tear down traditional public housing and replace it with mixed income, mixed neighborhood environments, that you'll see CDBG used oftentimes to connect the new facilities to the sewer city sewer systems. And because they're so old, and oftentimes most all public housing was built in the 40s and 50s, so they're on very old sewer lines that don't have the capacity to deal with, which EPA knows very much about, but don't have the capacity to deal with the volume that comes through those sewers. So you'll see CDBG funding used to enlarge those sewer lines and to also connect them to the new developments. Okay. Next slide. So when we look at specific populations, we're talking about people who pretty much so you can assume by the special population that they represent are low to moderate income people. So we're looking at folks who are homeless, the elderly, people with long-term disabilities, so a number of folks that we would know who would know likely have a very limited income. And so you can do special things as listed there. There are some activities including doing community centers for the elderly, and you'll see that oftentimes when you have both two types of developments, one, public housing developments, and then also the you'll see housing for the elderly that's produced under HUD multifamily housing programs. So you'll see community centers and senior centers built using for that specific population. And then services, although there's a cap on the amount of money in an entitlement's ability to provide service money, it's very competitive, and as the CDBG funding has shrunk over the years, that you'll see cities sometimes cutting out the services piece of the eligible activities and just focusing on the housing and community development and jobs piece. But you'll see there, those are some eligible activities. Another one would be to fund your local fair housing agencies to do fair housing education, which I think is an important piece when you look at the environmental justice issues that you're working with in the brownfields. So that's another eligible activity under services.
And Chris, the cap is a percentage of their award, isn't it?
It is. It's a percentage. I believe it is 15% of the award. I might be confusing that with something else. And I apologize. I'm not a technical expert.
I think that sounds right when you said it. But I just knew that. So obviously, the larger the award, the more potential there. But also, as you're saying, with the competition for funding, you know, certainly our area-wide grantees, you know, probably shouldn't count on that realistically as a potential source of service type funding.
That's a good suggestion, Charlie. Okay, we are on the next slide, which is jobs and economic development. And this is one that is extremely important, particularly as we look at the unemployment rates and our struggle to bring our employment back up to at least the same levels it was in 2008. But there's a number of things you can do here, and this will tie in as well with the Section 108 loan guarantee program that I'll mention later, because it could be an either or in how you would use your CDBG funds, depending on the size of the economic development project. But you're looking at benefiting folks in the low to moderate income category, at least 51%, and you can do a number of different things with it. You can develop businesses, businesses themselves, not just the incubator mentioned there. Oftentimes you'll see some of the CDBG funds used. Again, Hope6 is just such a good example for that, but you'll see that CDBG funds used for that as well. It could be for training for construction trades to work in the Hope6, so that's another activity that you'll see it used for. Now, housing, of course, is one of the main things that CDBG is sought for. And because it is so flexible and you can do so many things with it, that what we've also seen over time is once the home program that we'll discuss shortly came into play, that now you have some overlap of eligible activities under both types of funding. So you'll see home pick up some of the eligible activities that CDBG used to pick up. Point out a couple of things there: construction of housing by eligible organizations. And that would be your community development block. I'm sorry. It would be your what we call community-based development organizations. And you can also do rehab, whether it's rental or home ownership. There's a number of opportunities there. Energy conservation innovations that you can use as well. And there are limits when you're looking at rehabilitation or homeownership housing. There are limitations in regard to occupancy and special requirements there that you would have. Say one unit, if you were developing one unit, so a single-family house, it would have to be sold to a low- and moderate-income family. If you were developing two units, a duplex, it would be at least one of those would have to be occupied by the low- and moderate-income family. And then two units and above, there's other restrictions to that in terms of making sure the federal funds get the greatest use in regard to the population they serve. Okay. But those are the four categories under the activities benefiting low to moderate income people. And not that the next – go ahead and advance to the next slide. Not that this doesn't as well. It's just – how it was written a little bit differently under the law. And so prevention and elimination of slums and blight, the second major category, you can do historic preservation of blighted facilities. We have an example here in Louisville where there were some congressional grants that were the grantee was unable to complete a project, and so now CDBG funds are being used to secure the property at this point in time until it can be transferred to a new ownership. You can certainly do the demolition of other properties where they're abandoned or dangerous. So properties that may be in a neighborhood that is experiencing high crime, or if homeless people have begun to live in those abandoned properties and they're at risk for fire if it's cold, or other issues that come with homeless folks in unsafe housing. Okay, and so those are just a couple of examples, and I know there are several slides, so I want to keep moving us along here. Urgent need would more than likely be the last type, and it's not something that's used very often, but an example might be if you have a flooding incident, a flooding disaster, that you could see the collapse of septic systems that pose pose an immediate threat to the water systems locally. And so that would be a health and safety threat to the residents, and so that would be considered an urgent need. Now, if and that would be at the point of the disaster happening, the it would not be something you would apply for under urgent need for, you know, 3 or 4 years later to do a new water and sewer system. It would be not it wouldn't qualify under urgent need, that is. Okay, and so that's up to that point, that's CDBG, and I believe Mary is next.
Yes, thank you. This is Mary Oakley. As Charlie mentioned, I am with the Ohio Department of Development, which is the state-designated agency for the administration of Ohio's Small Cities CDBG program. Picking up where Krista left off, planning is also a CDBG-eligible activity, and communities can use CDBG funding to develop comprehensive plans, to develop community development plans, functional plans for housing, for land use, economic development, energy conservation, floodplain and wetlands management, transportation, utilities, or other plans and studies that maybe pertain to a smaller area, a neighborhood plan, for example, or a plan related to historic preservation. Under that, we see communities in Ohio looking for resources for planning for brownfields-type activities. In order to qualify to use CDBG funding for planning, the planning activity must meet the following requirements. The planning must be for a CDBG-eligible activity. The planning activity must produce a tangible product. Planning activities can only be undertaken for projects which, upon implementation, will meet at least one of the three national objectives that Krista mentioned. That's, again, the low moderate income benefit, the prevention or elimination of slum and blight, or the urgent need. The planning activity must also further the state's investment objectives. And this is where, getting back to a point Charlie made at the beginning, states have quite a bit of flexibility and discretion in designing programs that meet the CDBG eligibility guidelines, but also are tailored to what that specific state's investment objectives are. And then finally, the planning activity must be used to further the design and development of future applications to meet local and community economic development needs. Moving on to the next slide, this is really important because states do have so much flexibility in being able to design programs and create funding opportunities under the block grant umbrella. Some states, for example, choose to allocate the majority of their block grant funding to housing activities. Other states choose to focus on economic development or public facilities or public service activities. And I think the question had come up earlier about the cap on public service activities, and it is 15%. What we do in Ohio, for example, is because we're looked at from a portfolio standpoint, we will allow some communities that apply to us for assistance exceed that 15% cap, because we know overall our allocation is going to be less than 15% from the funding Ohio receives from the Department of Housing and Urban Development. States are required to solicit feedback from stakeholders in designing programs and allocating resources between a number of eligible activities. And as mentioned before also, states are required to submit an annual plan to HUD that includes a budget for the proposed program activities and outlines the specifics of funding opportunities. For example, what are the requirements of that funding? What is the application process? Is it competitive or is it a formula allocation? What is the deadline for application to the program? So all of those things are required to be in the plan that the state submit to the Department of Housing and Urban Development. And because each state makes so many decisions about how those funds are going to be used. Really, what a community needs to do is contact their local administrator, whether you are with an entitlement community or you fall into the small cities category, the less than $50,000 or 50,000 population for a city or less than 200,000 population for a county, you would follow fall under the state's small cities designation. On slide number 13 at the bottom is a link to HUD's website. And it's a really great link because you can click on that, click on your state, and it takes you to a list of your contact for not only your state's program if you are a small cities grantee, but it also lists out the administrative contact with fax, email, and phone number for all of the contacts for the entitlement communities as well. Moving on to slide number 14, I wanted to provide a little bit of information about the programs Ohio runs just to give the participants in today's webinar a little bit of information and an example of at least how one state allocates some of its resources. There are a number of different opportunities for brownfields planning and implementation activities in Ohio. The first is our formula allocation program, and the state awards grants to 130 communities annually. The amount of the grant is determined by a formula, hence the name, that takes into consideration the number of low and moderate income persons in the community, divides that into the number of low-moderate income population of the non-entitlement areas in the state, and then multiplies that by the amount of funds allocated to the formula allocation program for a given year. In Ohio, we have 130 grantees. I think our smallest grantee receives $50,000, and our largest receives over $700,000 per year from this funding source. The thing about the formula allocation program that's really unique is that the local government, your county or your city, makes the decision as to how those funds are going to be used. And when they apply to us, we review those applications for eligibility, attainment of a national objective, cost reasonableness. But the decisions about where those dollars go are actually made at the local level before the applications are even submitted to the state. We also administer a discretionary program, and the program provides funding for targets of opportunity, which are projects that are CDBG eligible, that Ohio feels are worthwhile for furthering the state's investment objectives, but do not fit into the tight parameters of any of the existing programs. So we've actually, over the years, done the majority of our brownfields implementation activities under our discretionary program because we are able to tailor the funding to the individual project and community situation rather than trying to pigeonhole a project into a funding source that just has parameters that aren't really designed to do that. Moving on to slide 15, we've recently established, the state of Ohio has recently established a new state-funded program called the Brownfield Planning Incentive Pilot Program. And this was actually established due to the great success that EPA had recently in awarding the area-wide planning grants to the 23 communities mentioned earlier. The state decided to use some funding to try to mirror that effort and to allow some Ohio communities that may not have been successful in applying for the federal program to access planning dollars to develop capacity in initiating brownfield redevelopment, to better prepare communities for obtaining funding either through other state programs or federal dollars for project implementation to assist with more of a coordinated redevelopment strategy when it comes to looking at brownfields that exist within a given community to improve the return on investment by increasing the predictability of the redevelopment process and to set the stage for sustainable communities by, you know, planning for economic redevelopment, housing, community services, and infrastructure investments. This is actually a state-funded program. This is not a program that is CDBG-funded. But what's neat about Ohio's initiative is that my office, the Office of Housing and Community Partnerships, which administers the CDBG funding for the state, is working very closely with our Urban Development Division that's rolled out this new pilot program. And the program was just, I think the applications for assistance were just posted to Ohio's website within the past month, and the applications are due on July 15th. I think decisions will be made no later than August 22nd. And I've got more information on Ohio's program if anybody's interested, either as part of the call or as follow-up afterwards. But what we're looking to do with this partnership is review applications together with my staff and the staff in urban development to see if there are opportunities where we can partner federal funding with the state's initiative, either to fund more projects, to be able to reach projects that have a higher dollar threshold that we wouldn't be able to do with just one program or the other. And, you know, as resources are becoming incredibly tight, we're going to be required to partner and leverage funding from as many different resources as possible in order to make some of these activities a go. And so we're pretty excited about this newly formed partnership. The other thing about it that's kind of neat is that right now, even though federal funding certainly is in jeopardy, we have some stable dollars that we can put toward a program like this, but we don't have out of this office the technical expertise to be able to guide grantees through a successful brownfields initiative, whereas the Urban Development Division has somewhat limited state funding, but they have the staff on board who can actually do the hand-holding and work with the local communities to be able to make the projects happen.
We actually had a question come in online. This is coming in from San Francisco, California, and they're asking to get a little bit more information about using a CDBG for removal of contamination on a land. They'd like to know if this is similar to a brownfields cleanup grant, and can those funds supplement a brownfields cleanup grant?
The answer is yes. We are able to use CDBG funding for any kind of cleanup of environmental contamination. And one of the things, again, with the block grant program being so flexible, we in Ohio have partnered with quite a few state and other federally funded programs to be able to do bigger brownfield cleanup type projects. And so I would suggest the caller contact the San Francisco, that would be an entitlement community, so those funds would flow directly from HUD to the city of San Francisco to see what kind of dollars they have in place as far as their block grant program goes, to see about partnering that with other federal and state sources for that project.
Thank you.
And this is Charlie, just one quick addition. And unlike EPA, the CDBG, right, you wouldn't require a 20% match for a cleanup project.
You do not. That's correct. Yeah. Moving on, Ohio has one other opportunity for communities to use CDBG funding for brownfields planning and implementation activities. We have 112 communities, rather, that operate CDBG revolving loan funds that can be used to finance planning and implementation projects for under the Slum and Blight National Objective. And one of the other eligible activities, economic development, is how these funds were created locally. We had made awards to communities for economic development and business development projects. They loaned those funds to a private for-profit entity, and when those loans were repaid, we allowed those funds to stay with the local government for other CDBG-eligible activities. Some communities have been very, very active in doing economic development. Others have not been. And so what we've been doing is encouraging communities to use those funds for planning activities or public facilities activities or brownfields activities in order to be able to get the funds revolving like they're supposed to be and getting the dollars out on the street to actually benefit more low, moderate-income Ohioans. Finally, I've got a couple of examples of projects we have funded with CDBG in the state of Ohio. The first one is the city of Fostoria, which is an urban industrial city in northwest Ohio. A couple of years ago, $500,000 in CDBG funding was awarded to the city of Fostoria for the demolition and cleanup of a 6.75-acre site. The site had been a junior high school, and elementary school complex, and although it doesn't sound particularly dirty, there were quite a few issues with asbestos, lead-based paint, and so the cost of the demolition and the cleanup was actually quite high. We provided a portion of the funding to the city. The city completed the cleanup and then was able to sell the site to a developer for the construction of a 58,000-square-foot Kroger grocery store. Kroger's had outgrown its site in Fostoria and was actually looking to leave the city or move out to more of a suburban area and develop a new greenfield site. And this cleanup enabled the company to stay in the downtown, provide grocery services to low, moderate-income residents of the city that live closer to the center city, and then create 63 full-time equivalent jobs, 33 of which were for persons of low and moderate income. We also, on the smaller side, awarded $10,000 to Lawrence County, which is at the southern tip of Ohio, right along the Ohio River. And there was a 740-acre site that was actually a Superfund site. And obviously our $10,000 did not go very far in helping with the environmental studies, remediation, and cleanup. But it was one more source of dollars that Lawrence County could leverage in order to assist with the cost of an environmental phase two site assessment. And they were able to evaluate potential uses for a site that had been out of commission for quite a while. This was a number of years ago, and although the site's not been completely cleaned up at this point, they've actually been able to bring in a number of industrial and manufacturing facilities, and I believe there are over 1,000 jobs that have been created at the 740-acre site. Even though, you know, CDBG just had a small piece in assisting with the environmental studies. Finally, my final slide, slide 18, and a couple of helpful hints for participating in your state's small city CDBG program. You know, the first would be to contact the state for a copy of the annual consolidated plan or action plan. And most states should have a copy of the plan on their website. This is really the ins and outs of what kind of funding your state offers through the CDBG program. You know, familiarize yourself with the type of programs the state administers. If there is a discretionary program, see what the parameters of the discretionary program are and whether that's something that if there's not funding set aside specifically for brownfields, planning or implementation type projects, see if there is a category like that, a discretionary category that may be able to provide assistance to a project. Look at the website link that was shared earlier that has the contacts for the state and the entitlement communities CDBG offices. Make contact with your representative. Ask the program representative to come to your community, to do a site visit, to do a one-on-one meeting. Talk about some of the needs of your community. Give them a tour. A lot of the ways in which we're able to provide assistance is going out into the field and seeing the issues firsthand that face our communities, and then being able to sit down and try to pull all the partners together at the state and local level to see what kind of resources we can all bring to the table in order to be able to provide assistance. Something that's worked really, really well in Ohio, a lot of our communities will take turns hosting seminars or outreach sessions to provide a forum for state and local funders to be able to present information on their programs and network. That way you get to know people, you get to know who to call for specific types of projects, and the funders get to know each other, so we're going to be more likely to reach out and get to know each other in order to be able to help your specific project. And then finally, ask how you can be involved in the state citizen participation process. Each state is required to go through a citizen participation process in order to get input from stakeholders as to how the CDBG funds should be used. In Ohio, we have advisory board meetings in October of every year, and we invite grantees and consultants and nonprofit agencies to come and talk with us about the programs we're running, recommend changes we can make to the programs in order to be able to better suit the needs of the local communities. And then we have a statewide advisory board meeting to which stakeholders come every January. And we go through the entire proposal for how resources are going to be allocated and allow the different interests to be able to, debate the pros and cons of how Ohio has proposed structuring funding for that next fiscal year in order to be able to, again, best allocate resources for the needs of our state. I think that's it for me.
Okay. Before we move on to the next program, thank you, Mary and Krista, for this information on the CDBG program, a great amount of information, and especially a great set of helpful hints. I just want to see if anybody on the line has any questions at this point on CDBG.
This is a reminder, if you're on the phone lines and you've muted your lines, you'll need to unmute. You can hit #6 to unmute your phone lines and ask your question.
Or people, I think Jean can just type them into you and you can
convey.
And
if they pop up later on, certainly you can type them in now, and we can get back to those questions when we take a break again as well.
All right. I guess just to keep moving, if there's no questions, verbally right now, I think we're going to turn it back over to Krista to talk about Section 108.
Thank you, Charlie. The section, one of the things I want to note as we start to go through Section 108 is that it is a loan guarantee program. You will often see it mentioned in the newspaper as a HUD loan or a loan from HUD, and it is not that, but it is a loan guarantee program using future CDBG funds to guarantee that loan. So it's used as a source of financing that is allotted for economic development, housing rehabilitation, the public facilities, rehabilitation, construction, all to benefit low and moderate income persons. So it can also be used to aid in the prevention of slums. So it has wide-reaching application in regard to what it can be used for, and it does come under the CDBG guidelines and statutes, so it would have to meet a CDBG-eligible activity and would be applied for either by the state in Mary's case, or it would be by the entitlement entity, the large city that would be a direct entitlement entity from the with HUD, from HUD funds. The one of the examples I'll give you in that as we go into the next slide is the, and you can Google this, but they're the biggest request for $100 million went into HUD last year, and it is for Museum Plaza. It's a development designed by Joshua Prince Ramos out of New York, and it is proposed for Louisville. So it is all public and online if you want to look at that, because it's been a little controversial because of the number, the amount of loan guarantee that's being requested, and the size of the development itself. But it is quite interesting. It looks to create 5,000 jobs overall, and some of those, of course, will have to meet the test to be the low to moderate income folks for the economic development portion of that. But it is used to revitalize, the goal is to revitalize, in this case, the downtown. But it can be used for a number of other activities. The best thing about Section 108 is that it helps leverage other sources of financing. So the that is the best part of it. The risk that a city or a state takes in using the Section 108 loan guarantees is that you are promising your future allotment of CDBG funds. So you can stretch the loan repayment out 20 years, or the guarantee out 20 years. It could certainly be a shorter period of time given what you intend to do with it, but it does allow you to do large-scale projects that you would otherwise have to do in installments over time once you get your annual entitlement. So let's go on to the next slide, and that is slide 20. And there are some examples of various ways you can use the loan guarantee. And again, it is very flexible. You can do rehabilitation, again, the business incubator, warehouse facilities. So you can use it as a neighborhood revitalization opportunity, because you could put a business or expand a business in a low to moderate income neighborhood and increase the job activity in that neighborhood. So that's just a couple of examples of how it can be used. All right. Next slide. And here are some of the, I mentioned these already, it allows you to leverage resources, large amount of resources up front in order to do a large project. The another example would be creating workforce housing near a either an industrial center or a burgeoning work center, so that people can work, live where they work, and that would be something that you could do in conjunction with the development of the industrial center and the housing coupled with that, that you would not otherwise be able to do with 1 year's entitlement or two. The you can leverage up to five times the amount of your annual entitlement, which of course changes from year to year given the appropriations process. And as I mentioned, you can do a loan term up to a maximum of 20 years. All right, let's go to slide 22. Some of the other benefits would be you do get it at a fixed rate. There's a couple of program benefits there listed. The one thing is that it does fix the rate, and so any of the future changes, the community is not at risk with any future changes. In that way. A little bit of the deeper financing issues there I'm not as familiar with, so I won't go into any detail with those, but they are there for your reference and certainly to discuss with your community planning and development representatives in your respective states. All right. And Charlie, I believe you were going to give a little bit of background on some of the projects that you are familiar with.
The slide, let's see, slide 23 is a repeat of some of the other things that we've already gone over in a previous slide. So we'll move from 23 to Worcester, Massachusetts.
Okay. Right. And the Worcester, Massachusetts project, I'm just going to go through these quickly so we can continue on. But this is a good example of how OneAway can be flexibly used. In the case of Worcester, what they did is they really used some of the OneAway resources to have a, I'm going to use the word pool, in place so that as they needed to provide credit enhancements, as they needed to make capital costs cheaper for prospective developers who were taking on contaminated type properties, the OneAway could be used in that way. And in the case of Worcester, you know, they draw down their OneAway only when they need to use it for specific projects. You know, the revenue to repay that comes from the projects. And I guess I also want to mention in this case, Worcester is not so afraid if they have to use some of their CDBG as a repayment if they need to meet the terms of the original 108, you know, the original 20-year terms. I think it's important to note that, you know, CDBG is a required collateral pledge, but that doesn't mean you have to use CDBG to pay it back. I mean, if the city as part of the project can come up with another revenue stream, well, then its CDBG can stay untouched during the course of the 108 process. And if we go on to the next slide in Wichita, this is a classic 108 use. An area that the city of Wichita was very interested in getting a redevelopment activity underway, a distressed area. And in this case, they used the capital availability that the 108 brought to it to get a Cessna aircraft facility built in a distressed area. And they also looked at it like many cities do when they're thinking about 108 in the context of the Cessna facility being an anchor facility and the 108 supporting sort of the additional cost of developing in a contaminated distressed area and also the cost of providing needed amenities to attract the private investment and attract the workforce to that area. And in the case of Wichita, that involved, you know, a learning and a daycare facility that the Cessna trainees used. In this case, you know, again, the 108 not only provided the development, but also, you know, it facilitated the job creation and the services. And the 108 is being repaid to Wichita, you know, from the revenue generated by the activities at the assembly facility for Cessna. So just a couple of quick examples of how 108 can be very flexibly used in the context of a site revitalization strategy. And now I want to turn it back over to Krista, who has this, who really says it all in her slides, sustainability at its best.
I absolutely love that picture, and it certainly speaks to our folks with the passion for brownfields redevelopment. And as you can see, it pretty much speaks for itself, and a wonderful reuse of a property that otherwise would have been vacant and abandoned and dangerous as well. So let's move on to the next slide. And for those of you who are not familiar with it, although EPA has been the leader in any type of environmental progressiveness for many, many, many years, the HUD has established the first office of sustainability or housing and sustainable housing and communities, excuse me. And that is the one part of a three-part federal partnership with EPA, the Department of Transportation, and HUD. And we were fortunate enough to get money through the FY 2009 funding from Congress to be able to open this office and fund it with grant funding. So the goal there, you see the mission of the office. And you'll see later in the Denver presentation that you'll see the livability principles and the guiding principles for all three of these federal agencies in the partnership. And so far it's working very well. And I'll go through some of the grant opportunities and information where we have been in the last 2 years and where we are headed with FY11 money. So there's we call it OSIC, that's what I'll refer to it as. So that is the OSIC website, but then the brand new website that was just established by all three of the federal partners
is the sustainablecommunities.gov website. And so they're beginning to, we are, not they, we are beginning to populate that. But if you want HUD-specific information, you would need to go to, or HUD-only information, you would need to go to the OSIC website. The other two federal agencies also have sustainability websites, so there's a lot of information out there, and I think the new website will tie that together nicely as it develops.
We actually had a question come in online. This is actually referring back to the 108 loans. They're asking if you could explain a little bit more about how Section 108 loan guarantee is set up. Are the localities selling bonds, and the CDBG funds are then used as backup bonds?
I might refer that to Mary. Mary, can you speak to that?
Ohio actually does not run a Section 108 program, so I'm not sure of the specifics. My understanding is that generally these are larger scale projects that are going to involve more financing than even the CDBG Section 108 loan program can handle. So generally, the few that have been done in Ohio through entitlement communities have had bond financing from other sources and then received the CDBG allocation for whatever the loan amount was to fill that gap.
And I can add to that with the, I didn't go into greater detail with the Museum Plaza project that I had mentioned, but the that is a $500 million project. So the $100 million loan guarantee through Section 108 is just a very small part of that. And there's private financing and developer financing and city tax incentives and lots of things that help bring that together. And that augments the information that Mary just provided as well. But usually they're very complex financing, packages.
Right. And this is Charlie. Just to add just a couple of points. I mean, HUD, as I understand it, and it is a very complicated process, and I think there's a lot of sort of individualities depending on the project, but HUD does help get those bonds placed so that you get the most advantageous rates. The person at HUD headquarters who runs the Section 108 program is named Paul Webster, and I think between Krista and I, we should be able to get you his contact information or an email address so you could follow up, or we could help facilitate that question getting passed along to Paul.
Okay, great. Yes, I'll follow up on that. Perhaps when we're going through the Denver presentation, I can get online and pick that information up and provide it. Okay, we are now on slide 28 for the Sustainable Communities Grant. And in fiscal year 2010, there were three types of grants announced. And one was an unprecedented partnership for HUD and I believe DOT as well to combine two grant opportunities into one that could be coordinated between DOT and HUD funding. That is the third one on the list, but let me first go into the regional planning grants. They're pretty much named very well in that they cover very large regions in regard to planning for smart growth and planning for infrastructure, transportation-oriented development. All of those types of activities could be looking at your zoning codes, land development codes, a comprehensive wide area plan. And in some cases, those plans were either in place and needed to be updated in order to be implemented, or they could be brand new regional plans for economic development and growth. So the application spoke to a number of different ways in which they could be used that were eligible activities. The community challenge grants they're smaller grant dollars, and they're also for smaller planning activities. So they, in one case, which I'll talk about shortly, it could be a neighborhood plan, it could be a larger community plan within a city, or it could be a city plan. But as opposed to the regional one, it would be on a smaller basis and a little bit smaller type of plan. And generally, you would see them as plans rather than plans ready to be implemented. which would be the case in the regional planning grants. And then the combination of the two, the Tiger II, which is the Department of Transportation funding, and that's flexible funding through the transit part of the Department of Transportation as opposed to highways, and the Community Challenge Grants. So we saw a number of those applications as well, and it was challenging for both federal agencies with all the challenges with security and the software systems and the security of the software systems to actually do a joint NOFA. So it's really pretty unprecedented for us to cooperate that well and to actually get that off the ground, as well as all the legal requirements in the two federal agencies. So those are exciting. These grants have been announced, and they're all in the process of the work plans being developed or implemented at this point. And so there are some very interesting things going on nationwide, and I'll show you a map here as we progress of where all those different grants are, and also where you can access the descriptions of the grants online. There are some innovative things going on with all three of these. Okay, giving you an example of a challenge grant. The title of their Covington, Kentucky's grant is a Downtown Action Plan, and the award is $360,000. And they are looking to have people move downtown, or at least stay downtown if they're already there. So a combination of both, and to decrease the miles traveled to get to work, so live and work downtown. They're looking to rehabilitate several buildings that are either vacant or really need a facelift in order to revitalize parts of downtown. And they want to increase their green space. And the other thing that is unique about this, and we're fortunate to be involved in, is that the City of Covington was also a recipient of a HOPE 6 grant, and so we are working with them, and that is within the downtown plan area. So it's going to be a combination of two types of federal funding in order to get this nice several square block area to where the city hopes it'll be. This particular city is also very progressive in regard to its health initiatives and how that ties into how you plan the city and how you work with it. So they've got a lot of really good things going on with they don't have a health impact assessment grant from the Centers for Disease Control, but that is one thing that they're looking at. But they're doing many of those types of initiatives in the downtown, if you are familiar with the health impact assessment grants. And this is an example of one of the regional planning grants. And the Central Florida Regional Planning Council is a rural region. So there were set-asides for there were large grantees such as, there were New York or those jurisdictions, Boston, I believe, received one. But we also had a set-aside for rural parts of states. And there is one actually that bridges Western Kentucky and Tennessee. That's an economic development initiative overall to use the waterways. And then here's another example of a rural one for the $1.4 million that the Florida Regional Planning Council received. So they're looking at, as you can see there, preserving natural areas while at the same time looking to develop and do more compact development to make it more economically viable and sustainable set of counties for that region. Next slide. This year, we have $67 million. Now, the very first round of funding, that was the FY10 funding, was $100 million for the regional planning grants, just to put this slide in perspective. It was $100 million for the regional planning grants and $40 million for the challenge grants, and the addition of the Tiger II money from the Department of Transportation. So it was a significant amount of money. The good news is, though, is that Congress did recognize the value of these grants and funded it in the continuing resolution for fiscal year 2011. And we have been quite aggressive about getting these out for announcement and subsequent award, because we are under such a crunch to even start working into the 2012 request for funding for these programs. So this year we have I've got Office of Sustainable Community Housing and Communities there. It is, I'm actually referring to the regional planning grant. And there are $67 million allotted to that grant program. And we've put an advance notice on the web. So if you go to grants.gov, you can find that information there, or on HUD.gov at the OSIC website. And that's to help folks get ready for the, there's some information there that you can begin the process. It's not the actual grant application. That's not available yet, but we're hopeful it'll come out very soon. Now, the community challenge grants, the Department of Transportation did not have the funding for Tiger II grants, or what would have been Tiger III grants for this year. They may be coming out with something similar later on, but the community challenge grants will be announced. As you can see, it's $40 million overall, and they'll be out a little bit later, because just as we had to blend the two federal agencies in order to create those grants, we now have to disentangle those so that we write it just as a HUD grant itself. So it will be a little bit later than the regional planning grant. Okay, next slide. And there is your map. This is also available online. And there's your map of the various grants throughout the country that were awarded. And so you'll see there, if you print that out, it might be a little bit easier to see in regard to the color coding. But the regional planning grants are the large study areas in the light blue. And then the other spots are various Tiger II challenge grants and a couple of other DOT grants as well. So there was a significant impact. And again, we're looking for another round of those and success with those. And I think they tie in very nicely with the planning grants that you're working on. So my strong suggestion would be to be in contact with the grantees. That information is online. We also have sustainability officers, 65 of them within HUD. And so you can either contact the field office director for the state, or contact one of the sustainability officers. We're dotted throughout the country, so there's not a sustainability officer in every state. But if you want to know who to contact for your sustainability officer, you can write to me, and I'll be glad to connect you with that. I serve as the sustainability officer, or the lead, for the Southeast. We have a total of 8 in the Southeast. Okay, next slide. Okay, and back to the 2010 information. Here we have the links I've given to you to look at the grant summaries. So in those summaries, you'll have the contact, you'll have the amount of the funding that each grantee received, and then also the contact for those grants. So if you want to be part of that partnership. And as I mentioned, where we are right now is all of the grantees have submitted work plans, and they are being reviewed jointly. The sustainability officers are coordinating the input on the ground from those. All of the grants are administered at a headquarters, but there's a very good partnership with the field in that we're participating in meetings, we being all three of the federal agencies, with the local grantee and providing technical assistance and whatever else they might need, other partners to bring to the table. So you could be one of those partners that may be vital to these planning grants as well. Okay, next slide.
Actually, at this point, I just want to see, before we move on to the housing programs, if anybody has any specific questions on the sustainability grants or even on 108, because I didn't call for specifics on 108. Okay, let's continue.
I do want to mention something I'd neglected to mention, the sustainability grants, going back to that is important, I think, for all of us. If you look back at it would be slide 30, the one for the Central Florida Regional Planning Council, they have been designated, or they're being watched very closely by headquarters HUD Washington in regard to the outcome measures. They
what we're seeing is that they have some of the best outcome measures of all of the grants across the nation. And so we're looking at those to be, depending on how they pan out, we're looking at those possibly as setting a norm or a standard for how outcome measures can be incorporated into future grants. So that's another interesting part of that particular, that the work that grantee is doing. Okay, let me advance here again. All right, and the Home Investment Partnership Program. This is another block grant program, and it is administered through states and through cities as well. The test for who gets this, or the threshold for who gets this money directly versus what goes to the state, is different than CDBG. So you could have a city who is a CDBG entitlement city, but not what is called in home terms a participating jurisdiction. So depending on where you are, the entity may not be the same in terms of who you would go to for what type of funding. But your local field office can tell you that, or your state agency can certainly tell you that, or your city. So this is another flexible funding opportunity that is used for housing development. It can also be used for rental. And there's a number of different ways in which that can be used. So we'll look at that here shortly. So you have the CHOTOs, the 15%. That's what I was thinking of actually earlier, was the 15% for the CHOTOs. So that works for the public services set aside as well as the CHOTOs. But that that money is set aside for those nonprofits to do housing development activities. And the that there are certain requirements that those organizations have to follow in terms of their board composition, in terms of the area that they serve, et cetera. So it's a very specific designation, and you would apply to your either your state or your participating jurisdiction, depending on who has the funds, in order to qualify as a development organization under that set aside. Next slide. Eligible activities. So you'll see, again, it's wide and varied, anywhere from grants and direct loans to demolition of dilapidated housing to purchasing to rehabilitating. Some of the other things that you'll see it used for is rental assistance, tenant-based rental assistance, where you do, it can be a maximum of 20 years, but one of the creative things we've seen people do is to take the home funding, use it as rental assistance as a bridge for people who are coming out of homeless programs into rental housing that's temporary because there isn't any permanent housing yet available, or they may be on a waiting list for housing authority properties or multifamily properties. So it's has been used as a bridge as well. But I think in the case of what you're looking at in terms of area-wide plans for brownfields, you would probably be looking at housing development and whether that be ownership or looking at the developing rental housing, multifamily rental housing. But it is a very flexible program.
Chris, this is Charlie. If a necessary step in the site improvement process included cleanup, could people use cleanup as part of that sort of batch of activities that they'd have to do?
I believe that is. I don't have that listed there as a specific activity. I know that you can do cleanup with the CDBG funds, but I'm not entirely sure. And I apologize. I am not a technician, and I sincerely apologize not being able to answer these more directly for your grantees on the phone.
But we might be able to find that out, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Great. Thanks.
If you can just take note of that question, we'll follow up and make sure we get the answer out to everyone. Okay, so here are some of the other activities that nonprofits can be involved in. A lot of what you'll see is the nonprofits working in the neighborhoods and knowing who their constituents are and working with them to do infill housing, to when they do acquisition of properties, to
fill in parts of neighborhoods and working with them. So the nonprofits have a very large role in working with participating jurisdictions in regard to using the home funds and as well as in some cases administering those home funds in the neighborhoods in which they work or the larger regions. Some of the CHOTOs work in larger regions as well. Okay. And okay. So there's a, let's see, let me get to my notes here. So some of the things that you want to look at that are challenging for the home program, particularly when you see the amount of the entitlement, the amount of the formula funding decreasing and the paperwork staying the same, is that you do have a 25-cent match for every dollar, and it has to come from a non-federal source. And that's become more and more challenging as cities and states have limited funds to come up with a match that does not include other types of federal funding. The this program has recently, if you've been anywhere, you have either seen the newspaper or heard a story in regard to the home program and the difficulty that that both the department has had and some grantees have had in terms of documenting its success. The Washington Post did a recent expose on this, and to which we are doing a follow-up to set the facts straight, a follow-up story. But it is one of the best programs and has been used for great, great things in terms of housing development. And if you go online either to the HUD website, in fact, on the front page there is a link to a video in that has several recipients as well as practitioners talking about their experience with the home program, and there's a number of things on YouTube as well. So it'll give you some flavor from another perspective in terms of how it's been used in the past. But again, it does have certain limitations and is restricted again to a different group of low to moderate income people. Not different, I mean they overlap, but there are different income requirements depending on what you're doing with it as well. All right, Charlie, do you want to see if there are any questions about that before going on to Hope 6?
Good idea.
Again, if you're on the phone lines, you can take yourself off of mute by hitting #6.
Looks like we're on to Hope 6.
Great. Well, it's a nice transition from home to Hope 6, and I realize we're getting a little short. I don't want to cut Denver off here. So the transition from home to Hope 6 is that home is used for gap financing, and that is one of the key uses that you'll see, whether it's in the development of housing for the elderly or housing for the disabled or for Hope 6 programs. And the Hope 6 has been one of the programs that has, it came in with an extremely high, when it first started, had a very high appropriation, which has dwindled over the years. We just recently announced in May the awardees for the fiscal year 2010, and we did use some of the fiscal 2011 appropriations to fund eight cities or eight public housing authorities of 36 that had applied, and congratulations to Denver because they were one of them, as well as Louisville. So it's a program that's done a lot of good in regard to taking down, again, traditional barrack-style public housing and that had become dangerous or dilapidated. A lot of times you'll even have seen structural damage that people had been living in because there wasn't another option. So that's the purpose of the Hope 6, and we will have the evolution and where our secretary is going with the Hope 6, as I advance to the next slide, is to the Choice Neighborhoods initiative, which will open it up to a larger group of eligible applicants. The Hope 6 has specifically been a public housing authority applicant eligibility only, And so you'll see and have seen some of the good things going on with that. There's a lot of green work going on in public housing, and so you'll hear a little bit more about that very shortly. But the certain requirements, as you see there, some things to consider in regard to the Hope Sixes. And we've seen a lot that are getting LEED certification all the way up to platinum certification for some of the work that they're doing in the Hope Sixes. So some fantastic work going on nationally. And here, transition into the choice neighborhoods. Again, there was $100 million overall between Hope Six, Choice Neighborhoods, which is coming out of the Hope Six pot for this year, and then this planning grant that's noted here. So the what you can anticipate is there will be a Choice Neighborhoods application in the near future out of the fiscal year 2011 funding. And it has the very much the same goals, but you'll see there's a little bit of a transition, even though the Hope Six grantees have been doing that for some time, but there's a little bit of transition in these planning grants to start looking at the sustainability practices and linking schools and transportation and jobs and mixed income housing. So it does have the same goals. It's just it's changing from a public housing only focus in terms of eligible applicants to a larger pool of folks who have good ideas. And I believe that's the last one besides the resource page. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much for all of that great information on the HUD programs. And I'm just going to even volunteer both Mary and Chris at this point to be on call if we have some follow-up questions after the webinar, because there's a lot here to kind of digest and think about how you might apply in an area-wide context. And I do want to make sure we have enough time for Kimball to give her example of how a lot of these, you know, resources and activities can play out in practice. So I think at this point we'll go to Kimball, and then we'll take whatever time we have left at the end for at least some questions. So Kimball, I'm going to turn it over to you.
All right. Thank you very much. It's nice to be here, and we're very excited about the Hope Six grant that we just received. So I'm going to give an example of how we in Denver have used some of the funds that have been talked about here today when I'm talking about our South Lincoln redevelopment, which is in central Denver in the La Alma Lincoln Park neighborhood here in Denver. You can go to the next slide, which just shows kind of the location of the site in context to the Central Business District. It's about a mile southwest of downtown. It is right on the light rail line that is already built, servicing Denver. It's about a mile from a large hospital in Denver, grocery store, pharmacy, a higher education campuses with three higher education schools on it. So it's a great location. On the next slide, however, you see that there has been physical distress that's been occurring, not only at the site but in the neighborhood. The public housing project was built in the 50s at a time when a lot of public housing sites were constructed in a form that concentrated poverty. So what we've seen at South Lincoln Homes is deterioration of physical elements, economic and social distress, isolation. It's great that it's now so close to the light rail line, but at the time it was built, it was tucked away against the heavy rail lines to kind of get it, you know, tucked back into the corner of the neighborhood. On the next slide, what you see is that that physical distress from our public housing site has started to spill over into the rest of the neighborhood. Lots of signs of abandoned and vacant buildings, underutilized lots. There's a high incidence of crime, gangs, drug activity, other educational and kind of health impacts that we've seen in this neighborhood as well that we'll get to in a little bit. But that physical distress is definitely not displaying attributes of a livable community, as we say. On the next slide, I talk a little bit about what pre-development activity has looked like. I think most people on the phone realize that large-scale redevelopment activities or even a project-based redevelopment activity require lots of different funds at different times. And before 2009, the City of Denver and EPA collaborated to award brownfield cleanup money at the site. And what that enabled us to do was be shovel ready at a time right when stimulus funds came out. So the site had been cleaned of a particular, the first phase of our redevelopment, and was kind of sitting vacant. We had gone through pre-development work with the community, and then stimulus was announced, which we were very excited about because it meant we were a shovel-ready project, and we did receive a $10 million stimulus award for the construction of our first phase. Our first phase is a 100-unit senior disabled building. It's about 60% through with construction right now. We're tracking LEED Platinum on that, and with the $10 million of stimulus award, we were able to leverage into a total development cost of about $22 million. So, you know, highlighting how important that pre-development activity was for our site can't be overlooked. We did continue on with community outreach for our larger scale revitalization for our existing South Lincoln Homes site, which was very community intensive. We went out to the community, you know, at this time it's been almost 200 meetings that we've had since the spring of 2009. And those have been community meetings, door-to-door interviews, different outreach activities with the different folks that live in the neighborhood and at our site. And our process for all of those community meetings was really to encourage community members guiding our master redevelopment plan. Change is never easy for people, and this was a neighborhood that people loved. Households have lived here, you know, families for generation after generation, and displacement was a very large concern for folks. So we were trying to devise a plan that would mitigate displacement, hedge, you know, not only physical gentrification, but also emotional gentrification, and allow folks the ability to stay in place if they wanted to while the redevelopment was occurring. So after all of the community outreach that we had done, it led to a need for more research that we recognized. And on the next slide, what you see is we started to put this framework together about how we could create a holistically sustainable community that was very livable for anybody that wanted to live there, regardless of your age, your income, your race. And we started asking questions that we were hearing over and over again in the community meetings that we had. And it was related to how do we provide better transportation options. For example, this site is right next to the light rail station called 10th and Osage Light Rail, and that's very convenient if you're going north and south in the city of Denver, but for a lot of people, they still need the bus to get around, and there is not bus connectivity to this light rail station. So we still have a long way to go in terms of how to truly make this a multimodal, transit-oriented development. How do we also incorporate sustainable housing, healthy homes, green living, but also looking at jobs, workforce development? How do we, you know, reduce our carbon emissions from each building? And we were starting to get out of our comfort zone a little bit. As Public Housing Authority, our work in the past has primarily been about housing. What we started to realize is that we needed more data on health. So we did actually conduct a health impact assessment using interview data, survey data from the neighborhood and our residents. Nearby Denver Health, they have data for us on the health of our residents and the neighborhood. We did a pedestrian environmental quality index to really view the quality of what the pedestrian felt at that level. And then we also did a food audit to determine if this was a food desert. On the next slide were some of the findings that we discovered, which were quite disturbing. You know, 65% of our residents don't have access to any type of motor vehicle. They couldn't borrow a car. They didn't have a family member with a car. and 54% take the bus. If you'll remember just a minute ago, I said there was no bus connectivity at this station. So to get to the bus, I mean, it's a walkable distance, but it's not right where the transit would be, you know, appropriate, right at the light rail station. Even though Denver Health is less than a mile away, 40% of our residents don't go there because there is no access to there if you're sick and you don't have a car. You know, only 28% of our residents were exercising regularly. 50% didn't feel safe about being alone at night in their neighborhood due to the violence and the drugs and the gangs that are prevalent. And so all of this data we were putting together to realize that the redevelopment we were starting to talk about to have the impact on our residents that we were looking for needed to be about much more than just housing. We had to look beyond the bricks and the mortar and start talking about things like, on the next slide, things that we organized into something we call the Healthy Development Measurement Tool. And the HDMT, as we call it, is something the Department of Public Health for the City of San Francisco created several years ago. And it was a method of taking health data from HIAs and other sources and organizing all of these different factors into things like environmental stewardship, transportation safety and access, the infrastructure of people, so culture, arts, adequate healthy housing, and jobs. And so on the next slide, what you see is we were getting inundated with information, and we really felt the need to create some sort of matrix that we could use along every step of our development activity so we could make sure that all of our decisions were incorporating these health outcomes. So we started kind of with our topics formalized, but we didn't really know how to fill in the boxes. And we knew that, you know, only one of these categories dealt with housing, so we knew we were going to have to form really solid partnerships, even more so than the ones we had. And on the next slide, there's an example of how we started to fill in some of these boxes. So when we start talking about environmental stewardship, you can see some of the boxes that we started to fill in. And to make this a really healthy place, like the bottom box says, maintain levels of community noise, safe levels. It's right next to a light rail. It's also right next to a heavy rail system. So how do we incorporate safer levels of interior noise? You know, it's not only a design question about windows and insulation, but it's also how do we work with DOT and the railroad? So there were all these options and opportunities with us to work for agencies beyond, you know, HUD or other local housing partners that we had. EPA is listed quite a few times in here, Department of Agriculture. We've started thinking about Live Well, which is a local nonprofit effort to try to bring healthier food access into neighborhoods in Denver. So we did this for all of our categories, and on the next slide, what you see is our summary of our HDMT guidance tool for the South Lincoln redevelopment. We got really excited when we put this together because it put down in words what I think we assumed was the way we would have redeveloped, but during a redevelopment process, things get dropped. There's not as much accountability outside of the boundaries that you have control over. We really wanted a matrix that could keep us accountable and keep our partners accountable to what the community's desires were. So this is a summary of it. There's a whole report that goes along with this and, you know, check-in tools, thresholds, goals that we're incorporating into our redevelopment. On the next slide, you know, it's been talked about today already about the Partnership for Sustainable Communities, and you can even skip ahead to the next slide, which talks about the six livable principles. We got so excited about this because it matched up very closely with our HDMT report. This was all kind of happening at the same time, and we really felt like South Lincoln was a model neighborhood that we could try to incorporate livability principles while we were redeveloping. I think we were fortunate enough that we were heading in that direction, got the added boost from the federal announcement of this effort, And we're able to catch ourselves during master planning to really incorporate a lot of these into our revitalization plan. On the next slide, you know, we did have partnership for sustainable communities by our Region 8 offices for the South Lincoln redevelopment, and we had planning meetings in 2010, and then we had a series of working meetings and charrettes that happened really and are still happening over the last year. When we talked about our energy charrette, we partnered locally with the National Renewable Energy Lab, NREL, here in Denver, west of Denver, as well as sustainability consultants, energy modelers, EPA, Denver Housing Authority, and we created new RFP language about how we wanted our buildings to operate. So we've been very well practiced in Denver about green building. We regularly use geothermal for heating and cooling. We have PV on quite a few of our roofs. We follow Enterprise Green Communities. We have several LEED certified buildings at different levels. And what we wanted to do was take that a step further and say, you know, it's great to have these certifications, but how are we actually decreasing our environmental footprint? How are we decreasing the emissions that our units are putting off? And how are we making our residences live in a way that it's very easy for a tenant to behave in a green way. So that was what happened, and the tangible result of that was that we got language to put into an RFP that we were able to issue for our next phase of this redevelopment site. We went through similar charrettes for transportation about how to make this more of a multimodal area, and you know, all of these charrettes have spun off different activities that we're still working on, which are pretty incredible. They're not only interagency partnerships on the federal level, but it's trickled down to the local level, which for us is very critical for the day-to-day things that we need to implement. So on the next slide, you know, just giving a quick overview of some of the funding that we've received on the front end and the back end. You know, the front end, we received the cleanup funding, which isn't on this slide, but for the site, the first site of our redevelopment, and that was about $230,000. That enabled us to be ready to go, which set us up for our first phase of redevelopment funded by stimulus in part. And then EPA came in and allotted an assessment grant for our asbestos and demolition surveys for our future Hope 6 site, that we just received an award for. And then EPA Brownfield Sustainability Pilot funded the funding for the three charrettes that I was mentioning. On the next slide, you know, other sources received have been the $10 million in stimulus in 2009, which leveraged $9 million of tax credit and energy tax credits, and then $2 million from the City of Denver. In June, actually, last month, or this month, seems like a long time ago, we received news of a Hope 6 grant from HUD for the $22 million that we requested. With that funding, we also had commitments for CDBG and home funds, State of Colorado home funds, low-income housing tax credits that can be leveraged into substantial equity and debt. And so, you know, for us, it's been a matter of really doing our homework up front, really digging into what the community has needed, and then, you know, out of a series of a lot of work and being ready to go, we've been able to leverage a lot of funding sources and good timing. So on the next slide, what you'll see is just kind of the next steps for our redevelopment. We're going to be continuing implementation of our revitalization plan. We're in design of phase two of that, which is our first phase of our Hope 6 grant application. And so that is expected to break ground in February. We'll be continuing to work with the Partnership for Sustainable Communities. It's been a very natural relationship for the agencies involved in Denver. We've had tremendous support from our federal, state, and local partners, and it's been wonderful here. In terms of our first building, those are two pictures of that there. It's 60% through with construction right now. It is scheduled to be done in January. part of our relocation and hedging against displacement plan for our Hope 6 phasing was to do a rolling demolition and a rolling reconstruction approach so that we're building units where we can relocate folks into before we demolish units. So even though South Lincoln Homes is 270 units, our first phase of Hope 6 redevelopment includes only 38 units of demolition. So that's something that we're pretty excited about. So the second phase won't start construction until February after this first phase is open. The next slide is just my contact information. So if anybody has any questions, I'd be more than happy to take them.
Thanks, Kimball. I think what's so really, really cool about the example that you laid out is how, you know, such a range. I mean, so many of the HUD resources we talked about on this webinar, you kind of pulled together and kind of really marshaled into this great project. And I think we will open it for questions specifically to Kimball. And if anyone has any other questions, I know we're running a little over, but we want to have time to take them.
Again, if you're streaming the audio online, you simply need to use that question mark icon to type up your question or comment. If you're on the phones, it's #6 to unmute your line.
And we've put our contact information up there. I mean, please feel free to contact any of us directly with email questions after the webinar is done. Well, Jean, I think, I mean, we're already about 20 minutes over, and I imagine people need to kind of get on with their schedules. So if you want to go ahead and close it up.
Sure, I go. Thank you. But with that, I will direct everyone to the final slide, which is slide number 63. And on that slide, you'll find those two links that I mentioned when we started things today. Again, the first link you'll see there's an additional resources page, which can also be accessed from the seminar homepage. So if you have a print copy, you can go back to the email messages and view the seminar homepage and follow the links on the left or the bottom to the additional resources page, where you can download not only today's seminar slides, but also other resources that are related to the topic. The other link on slide number 63 is our short feedback form. We do ask if you could take just a minute or two to fill it out and let us know what you thought of today's seminar. We do read each and every single one of those responses, so that does help ensure that we can continue to offer the free online training like this through Kluent. If you're looking for confirmation, when you get to the feedback form, there's a box that you can actually check, and a confirmation email will be sent to you for your own records. If there are multiple people sharing a computer today, once you fill out feedback from that computer, there'll be a link that will appear on the following screen that will allow you to submit feedback for a separate person. So the form will reopen, and the next person can submit their own information. So if you registered and under one name, each person can actually fill out feedback and get their own confirmation message. Again, that same form is also available at the bottom of the seminar homepage. So if you don't have time to fill it out now, you can certainly come back to that page and fill out feedback later on when it's convenient. If there are no other questions or comments on the line, I don't see anything else submitted, and I don't hear anybody else on the phone lines. I just wanted to officially thank our organizers from EPA's Office of Brownfields Land Revitalization for setting up today's seminar, as well as the speakers who joined us from around the country. And I also want to thank all of the participants who dialed in or signed on online to listen to the streaming audio. We appreciate your participation today and hope that you found this to be a valuable expenditure of your time. In about 1 to 2 weeks, you will get an email from me indicating that the archive is available, and you'll be able to replay today's session. So if you found it useful, you want to refer it to colleagues, you can certainly forward that email to anyone you think that'll find it helpful. And remember to come back and check out the other almost 400 archive seminars we have available on Kluent. With that, that will be the formal conclusion of today's session. Thank everybody, and hope you have a great rest of the day.